Good evening, everybody. This is Peter Laws, and it's good to welcome you back to the Flicks the Church Forgot, the podcast that watches horror films from a theological perspective. Now, follow me on Twitter at Rev Peter Laws, or you can look me up on Facebook at the Flicks the Church Forgot. Tonight, I'm going to be looking at a subject I never thought I would get round to, mainly because for so long I just was not interested in it. But after a recent few revisits to some key horror films, I've discovered a newfound appreciation for a horror icon I had long thought tedious. Turns out he's nothing of the sort. Tonight, we're in the laboratory of Dr. Frankenstein. Well, the festive period has come and gone, but on Christmas morning, while my kids were foaming at the mouth with delight as they tore open Barbie houses and train sets, I was sitting there gently peeling off the paper to a cracking Blu-ray box set of Universal Horror Monster movies. 8 films restored and remastered for HD with stacks of extras. Now, this set has been around for quite a while now, so it's quite old news, but I'd only just gotten around to order it. And now you need to understand that I've seen most, if not all, of these films before, but this was like way back when I was in my early teens. So it's been like 25 years or so since I rewatched this stuff, and I figured they were ripe for reappraisal. And there on the cover is an array of 8 different monsters leering out of the cover art, creatures that have terrified audiences from the 1930s onwards and still influence horror and popular culture today. Now, I've said in these podcasts before, and I'll say it again, not all of these monsters do it for me. As far as classic horror villains are concerned, my favorites have always been vampires and werewolves. I get those two. Those two, to me, have an almost inherent appeal. They feel frightening and actually quite threatening, and I wouldn't want to bump into them peering around a tree during my midnight woodland walk. But the other classic horror guys have left me a little bit cold. The Mummy, for instance, as I've said before, I'm not really into. I'm not a mummy's boy. That creature just doesn't appeal to me very much. Oh, I like the idea of knowledge-hungry scholars riding roughshod over superstition just so they can add more chapters to their textbook, but then finding that the curses they've derided are more powerful than their so-called rational enlightenment. Oh yeah, that stuff's really cool. I enjoy all that. I like the angle to it. But it's the mummy itself, which is a little tedious to me, shuffling about, trying not to unravel. I watched Karloff in his 1930s version of The Mummy recently, which did have a few creepy moments, particularly at the very beginning. And it's got some excellent makeup, but on the whole, I don't know, I'm just happy to leave The Mummy largely unwrapped. The Invisible Man, well, that's a mildly diverting science fiction idea, but it's never really felt like a horror to me. I haven't actually watched the James Whale version as yet. That's next on my list, so maybe I'll be impressed. But The Invisible Man's never really struck me as a true horror icon. Okay, in the year 2000, Hollow Man tried to tip The Invisible Man into a more deranged and scary approach, but still, I think that monster lacks depth and dimension, if you know what I mean. The Phantom of the Opera, Creature from the Black Lagoon, I mean, I'll need to rewatch all that stuff before I pass comment on them. But that leaves me with Frankenstein. Now, I remember loving Bride of Frankenstein when I watched it in my early teens. Even back then, as a geeky little kid, I think I could already recognize the genius of that film. How well put together it is, how quirky and dark and touching it is. Yet I remember it was really the story and the ideas and the settings that appealed to me way back then. It wasn't Frankenstein's monster itself. In fact, I just found him to be a lumbering oaf of a guy stomping around saying stupid things like, "Friend good, fire bad." And there's a reason why I just tended to mock Frankenstein's monster, and it's simple. I don't live in a cultural vacuum, and so Frankenstein's monster has been so diluted by popular culture that it's hard to see him with fresh eyes. Unless you saw this film when it first came out, then more modern audiences, I think, tend to see the monster through a sort of pop culture filter. And Frankenstein's monster is a horror icon that has been relentlessly squeezed, mocked, and filtered so that it's hard to take him seriously, at least at first. When I think of Frankenstein's monster, in particular Karloff's rendition, my mind instantly leaps to the Munsters and then to Young Frankenstein with Mel Brooks, or I think of Dark Shadows, the TV show, which I'm thoroughly enjoying working my way through, but I'm currently at the point where there's this sort of Frankenstein monster called Adam who just sort of clumps about the place in his knitted green jumper looking for a girlfriend. Hardly the stuff of nightmares. Heck, I even watched the Adam Sandler animated movie recently, Hotel Transylvania, with my daughter, and the Karloffian creature in that turns out to be a thoroughly domesticated and reduced monster. Fun though it may be. Vampires, I would say, have survived a similar pop culture onslaught. When I read Stoker's original Dracula or I watch Todd Browning's 1931 film, I'm not actually thinking instantly about the Count in Sesame Street. You know, Vaughn, that's Vaughn, hot dog, I'm able to keep that in the back of my mind. I don't know, maybe there's an inherent threat there in vampires that means that lots of cultural deconstructions do not dilute the fascination or the fear with the character. And yet Frankenstein's monster, I think, is one that is much more easily mocked. You know, just stand up, stick out your arms, clump your boots about for a bit without bending your knees, and you'll giggle with the idea of being Frankenstein's creature. Until, that is, I sat down just a few days after Christmas and I rewatched the original Frankenstein and then The Bride of Frankenstein, both of which are in that box set I mentioned earlier. Both films released in the early to mid-1930s. And as I sat and watched these films, I decided to do something I hadn't really thought about doing before. I made a conscious, active decision in my brain. I was going to switch off my pop culture filter, and I was going to watch this from the vantage point of a world where there was no such thing as the monsters. There was no young Frankenstein. Where there was no subconscious area of my brain filled with Super 8 movies of sun-bleached Polaroids of little kids from the 1950s dressed up as Frankenstein's monster for Halloween. Instead, I just sat there in front of my big old 46-inch screen hanging on the wall, pulled up a comfy couch directly in front of the screen, cranked up all the wall-hanging speakers so I'd be enveloped by it, although, to be honest, it turned out to be in mono, but turned out the lights and watched Frankenstein like I was in some 1930s vacuum. And I watched it for what it was and what it certainly is, and that is a horror film. And with my mind uncluttered in this way, I quickly started to get annoyed at that old cliche that I've heard so often in reference to these old Universal films, that they are simply not scary to modern audiences anymore, because we have so moved on that we can put these once shocking movies on at 2 p.m. in the afternoon on TV and nobody cares. Because after all, they are all utterly innocuous, aren't they? How dismissive modern audiences can be of these sorts of films. Because I think if you watch them right and open your mind to it and allow yourself to accept what is going on, you find something that you don't expect. Particularly in Frankenstein. Something that loads of other horror fans that have seemed to have figured out a long time ago, but it's taken me most of my life to work out. That actually Frankenstein is as horrifying as it is heartbreaking. Now, first up, I'm going to give a review of a few key Frankenstein movies, and then after that, we're going to be digging a lot deeper into the theological and sociological themes that we find going on in this story. So let's switch on the Tesla coils and release the kites as we spend a night with the man who would be God.
Here's the final touch. The brain you stole, Fritz.
Yes.
Think of it. The brain of a dead man, waiting to live again in a body I made with my own hands. My own hands.
My family and I visited the Black Country Museum up in Birmingham last year, and while I was milling about in the lobby, I noticed a set of display boards that listed famous residents who were born there in the Black Country. Now, just in case you're worried that we have an extreme racial segregation thing going on in Britain, actually the name Black Country derives from the fact that there was so much coal mining in that area that lots of men were constantly covered in soot, hence the Black Country. And it turns out that from this ominous underground shadowy world emerges a man called James Whale, who was born there in 1889. Now, Whale lived a rather fascinating life. He joined the British Army in World War I and became an officer, but then he does a homeland and gets taken as a prisoner of war. And it's during his captivity that he realized that the real interest in life for him lay in drama. To be honest, I'm sure if I was a prisoner of war, I'd be fondly looking on some alternative career options too. But Whale really did make something of this ambition. He was released and then he became an actor, a set designer, and ultimately a director, which brought him to Hollywood, where he worked for the rest of his life. He made all sorts of well-regarded films, big smash hit like Showboat, but it's his Universal horrors that are of most interest to us. In particular, Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein. Now, Whale wanted to direct Frankenstein because he, perhaps understandably, was getting sick of doing war films. And the two films he ended up creating have left, his strongest cultural legacy. His version of Frankenstein is based on a play by Peggy Webling, which of course is based on the Mary Shelley novel. Now, I hardly need to tell you the story, do I? But just in case, it's about the ambitious young Heinrich Frankenstein, or Henry, who is obsessed with creating life from body parts, and he gets his assistant, Fritz, not Igor, to steal the brain of a normal, intelligent guy, but the idiot drops it and so brings the brain of a criminal instead. Dope. Now, Frankenstein shoves that in the creature's noggin, and then he starts to harness electricity and lightning, and before you can say Herbert West, the monster is twitching, moving, and gazing with dead-looking, but nonetheless open eyes, and seeing his creator. Now, there is a lot to like about James Whale's film, particularly when you watch it as if you were an audience member of the 30s. Because when you do that, you really do feel like this is a horror film. And by that, I mean it's horrible. Like, it really does explore taboos and morbid topics with an explicitness that is pretty groundbreaking at the time. It's got shots of human brains in jars, dead bodies on morgue slabs, syringes being jabbed into a body being thrown off a windmill and bouncing off the structure, and perhaps most controversially, a little girl being drowned by the monster and then carried through the village by a grieving father. It is all very, very dark and macabre, and I can only imagine what the genteel audiences of old would have made of him. Well, I guess we don't have to imagine, because while the film was a hit, a lot of critics were disgusted by it. The movie famously got into hot water because of its apparent blasphemy, with Frankenstein's line after creating the monster being this, you know, he goes, it's alive, in the name of God, now I know what it feels like to be God. Now, I'll discuss those lines. Great impression, eh? I'll discuss those lines and the initial Christian reaction to the film later in the deeper analysis, but those lines are delivered with such enthusiastic insanity that they sound like they typify the mad scientist trope in horror, and with this blasphemy edge, I guess it's not a surprise that some people back then got a bit of a shock. However, if you watch the film on the whole, I think Dr. Frankenstein is not an all-out nuts mad scientist. In fact, you can start to appreciate why he might want to learn to create life. It's an undoubtedly interesting experiment and could have some very helpful applications. And so I personally think it's fair enough if he gets excited when the experiment he's doing actually works. Now, Colin Clive, who plays Frankenstein, is fantastic in this. His strong British accent sounds like the sort of guys you get in old war movies and public information films. And speaking this material makes his dialogue sound madly earnest and convincing, and I think he's really quite captivating. Now, I'm not sure what it is about Colin Clive, but I think in both of these films, he really draws you in. And while Karloff is fantastic in this, and we'll get to that, I think Clive is a vastly underrated element in the success of this and the next one, Bride of Frankenstein, which we'll turn to in a moment. And it's tragic, actually, to discover that this talented and enigmatic actor only lived a couple of years after Bride of Frankenstein. Born in 1900, he died in 1937 of complications of tuberculosis. He was a chronic alcoholic, and he began drinking whiskey simply to overcome stage fright. And his alcoholism was apparently clear and obvious to many of his co-stars, and 300 mourners turned out for his funeral, and Peter Lorre was even a pallbearer. What I love about Clive's portrayal of Dr. Frankenstein is he seems so conflicted with his ambition. He has this desire for knowledge on one hand, which is battling against the norms and values of his generation. Values that are on one hand understandable, but on the other are really quite paranoid and restrictive. You know, to know that Clive himself was such a troubled man in his own personal life makes, I think, his portrayal in this just that bit more powerful and tragic. The production design of Dracula is superb, as it is in The Bride of Frankenstein, with just incredibly high ceilings and multi-leveled sets. They just don't make them like this anymore. And Whale uses shadow and blackness to amazing effect. I mean, he certainly seems influenced by German expressionism, which loved to exaggerate light and shadow. Or maybe he was given a taste for the dark growing up wandering past all those open mines in the Black Country. At that museum, my family and I went down into one of the mines with hard hats and torches, and switching them all off at the very deepest place is an experience where you realize that in your life you hardly ever experience pitch black. And seeing it for real feels like it is pressing against your eyeballs. It is oppressive darkness. This was Whale's country, and it clearly gave him a love for the shadows. Now, on rewatching Frankenstein, maybe with adult eyes as opposed to 12-year-old eyes, I found it to be at times really quite disturbing and ultimately a heartbreaking story, which is a thread that runs through the entire Frankenstein subgenre. I'll be returning to the sadness of all of this later as we dig deeper, but for now, let's turn our attention to Whale's bombastic sequel, Bride of Frankenstein.
Come, Mary. Come and watch the storm.
You know how lightning alarms me.
Astonishing creature.
I, Lord Byron.
Frightened of thunder, fearful of the dark, and yet you have written a tale that sent my blood into icy creeps. Look at her, Shelley. Can you believe that bland and lovely brow conceived of Frankenstein? A monster created from cadavers out of rifled graves? Isn't it astonishing?
I don't know why you should think so. What do you expect? Such an audience needs something stronger than a pretty little love story. So why shouldn't I write of monsters?
It wasn't long after the first film was released that work began on a script for the sequel. However, there were various issues with getting a screenplay together, and so we find that the first sequel to Frankenstein doesn't show up from the Universal until 1935. That's 4 years after the original release. Ironically, though, I think the slow cooking of the script over those years really paid off, because it really is quite a masterful horror film. Just a masterful film, full stop. Here, Colin Clive returns as Baron Frankenstein, who this time has been forced to produce a new creature from dead parts to befriend Karloff's monster from the first film, because apparently the poster proclaims the monster demands a mate. Not surprising, really, since everyone else seems to treat him like crap. Now, I say that Frankenstein is forced into this because he's had a change of heart since film one. He's not keen on reanimation at all anymore, and it's only when his hand is forced, when he has little choice, that he decides to do it. Though it is pretty cool to see that once he has pushed into it, he starts to recapture some of that original enthusiasm for bringing back the dead. Now, Bride of Frankenstein is widely thought to be a better film than the original, and though in some ways I think that's probably a pointless statement, they are just very different movies. As a slice of pure horror and disturbingness, I think the original film from 31 could be argued to be the best, but as far as filmmaking is concerned, I do think that Bride of Frankenstein really is something of a masterpiece, and does stand taller than Frankenstein in terms of just pure film-like brilliance. The story cracks along at a thrilling pace. It's got this utterly bizarre and quirky side streets to explore. And plus, Whale adds in a whole bunch more characters that make the film seem to just burst with life. The character of Dr. Pretorius as the man obsessed with raising the dead and forcing the Baron to join him, he's just fantastic. Film critic Kim Newman helpfully points out that the original film is wonderful because of Karloff's monster, whereas the sequel has these other larger-than-life characters like Pretorius, so that while Karloff's monster certainly isn't diminished, he's great in this, he is alongside other unforgettable portrayals. Pretorius is played by the stage actor Ernest Thesiger, and of course, as well as Pretorius, you have the bride herself, played by Elsa Lanchester. I mean, talk about iconic. She's barely even in the film. Lanchester is in the prologue when she plays Mary Shelley, and I just love this scene. I really like it. I don't know if you're supposed to like this scene or if it's just filler, but I think it's cool. It's a great way of opening the film and a great way of recapping the original film. But then Lanchester crops up later, only in the closing minutes, as the bride of the title. But the makeup on her and her portrayal of this character just etches itself into the psyche so that it feels like she has been hovering this entire movie. In fact, her theme certainly has it. In the background, in Franz Waxman's score, you can start to hear the theme for the bride coming even before the bride ever makes an appearance. And the bride's makeup manages something I think is seriously clever. It is both subtle and striking. It is both beautiful and frightening. And it is both sexy and repulsive. I bet David Cronenberg would have fallen in love with this bride. Now, makeup maestro Jack Pierce has long been appreciated, and rightly so, for his makeup in the Universal years. His Frankenstein design really is wonderful once you filter out all those annoying parodies you've seen of it down the years. And his work on The Mummy is fantastic, I mentioned that earlier, though I did think his design for The Wolfman was a bit cutesy. But anyway, I think Pierce's makeup work for the actual Bride of Frankenstein is one of his finest examples of his makeup wizardry. Though it's worth pointing out, though, that the design of the bride had a lot of input from Whale himself, especially with this Nefertiti-style haircut But when you look at the creature designs in horror movies since then, from your cookie-cutter looking vampires and demon face prosthetics that you'd show up on programs like Buffy or Twilight, why do they all roughly look the same? Or the countless generic-looking zombies that lurk the halls of horror relentlessly? It's designs like The Bride of Frankenstein that remind you that when you're looking at these films, you're seeing the work of true pioneers at horror's sort of creative visionaries. Almost 100 years later, and I see this design echoed in toys and dolls that my daughter loves in the toy shops, Monster High and all that stuff. Heck, I was watching the Sooty Show with my kids the other day, and the Bride of Frankenstein turned up in that, albeit through the medium of Sue. Another thing to mention is the music by Franz Waxman. I've mentioned it just earlier before, but it's a superb soundtrack, and it's full of rich thematic ideas and clever little melody tricks. And at the moment, I've just got it pretty much on a loop on my Spotify playlist. I think it's a fine example, as any, of Golden Age movie scoring. And here in The Bride of Frankenstein, the production design gets even more lavish, with a castle laboratory of immense height, complete with a cool body slab pulley system to lift the corpses up into the stormy night sky, as these kites blow about in the wind, harnessing the power of the heavens. It's just wild. There's also a lot of humour in this one, more so than the largely oppressive atmosphere of the original, so there are laugh-out-loud moments and funny, sharp dialogue. Its only misstep? For me, it's the bit when Dr. Pretorius reveals what he's been working on. Tiny people he places in jars. Now, this might have been a fun optical illusion to shove in a film, and director James Whale obviously got a kick out of it, because as I recall hearing once, it was his insistence that this sequence should go in. But I just find it all a little bit too outlandish and silly. It pulls the grim and creepy but believable story of Frankenstein into this land of silly fantasy. And not least, I was left thinking, hang on a minute, Pretorius views his own experiments as pretty much failures or fun dabbling in the shadow of what Baron Frankenstein has achieved. But what Pretorius has produced is in many ways superior to this monster. These are tiny people, perhaps, but they are people. They can talk quite clearly. They, unlike me, they look fairly normal and they move like real humans. And apart from their size, they are much superior examples of creation than the lumbering monster of Frankenstein's dead tissue robot. Yet the film suggests that Pretorius' previous work is just a warm-up and that he is in awe of the creature in some way. They may be small, but size, as they say, doesn't always matter. And I think his little guys might be tiny, but they seem more advanced. Anyway, that was just something that I wanted to get off my chest. The film still had trouble with the censors, particularly with some references to God and Jesus, which we'll look at later. But one interesting objection came from the Japanese, because like me, they didn't like the bit with the little people either, though their reasons were a little different to mine. They disagreed with seeing Henry VIII being picked up with tweezers because such an action blatantly was, quote, making a fool out of a king, end quote. Ha! Well, we've explored two classic Frankenstein movies from Universal. There are others, but we're not going to look at those, I'm afraid. We're just focusing on the James Whale one and two. But you can tune into the next episode where we're going to be exploring Hammer's Curse of Frankenstein and also Reanimator, a little bit of that, and Frankenstein, The True Story, a TV miniseries from the 70s that's getting a release upcoming in the UK in March. We'll look at that in the next episode, and then in episode 3 we'll be digging far, far deeper into this and trying to work out the sociological, theological, and psychological beating heart of the Frankenstein story. But until then, don't forget the flicks the church forgot.